The good news about genetically engineered food is that we don't know of any cases where anybody has been killed. The bad news is we haven't done research to understand what the impacts of this new regime of food is likely to be.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square to discuss an important topic, Monsanto. Actually, its new name is even smaller, Bayer. The giant German pharmaceutical company has bought them out. They did that in May. And instantly, this new giant biotech conglomerate became the world's largest seed and pesticide company. As noted by Forbes, its history, products, and culture will linger. Bayer cannot change Monsanto's history. And it is that history that we're going to focus on tonight, namely Monsanto's widely used weed killer, Roundup, a product which has been used globally for the past 40 years in food production and which is now linked to cancer. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we have with us Professor Sheldon Krimsky from the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Tufts University. Professor Krimsky has a new book coming out in the spring entitled GMOs Decoded, A Skeptic's View of Genetically Modified Food. Today, two interesting stories hit the headlines with regard to glyphosate. That's the active ingredient in Roundup. CNN reported that dozens of common breakfast cereals and snack bars had been found to contain glyphosate, a controversial herbicide which is now linked to cancer. Two, a California judge denied Monsanto's request to overturn the guilty verdict, which had been ruled against them in a landmark case several weeks ago. It instead upheld a jury's verdict that Monsanto's popular weed killer, Roundup, A, caused the cancer of the terminal patient, and B, failed to warn him of the dangers of using it. The plaintiff, a former groundskeeper, Dwayne Lee Johnston, who's dying from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, told The Guardian, "I hope they get the message, Monsanto, that people in America and across the world are not ignorant. They have already done their own research. I hope people get the picture and start to make decisions about what they eat and what they spray on their farms." I'd like to introduce Professor Sheldon Krimsky.
The big picture about glyphosate is that it's connected to GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and the whole field of biotechnology and food, which began to become commercialized in the mid-1990s when the first products came out. I found it rather confusing that we have laws in the books that say that if you put a foreign chemical into a food, you have to test that food with the foreign chemical to see if it's safe. But in the Reagan administration, they set up a commission headed by Dan Quayle. Quayle. Some people may have forgotten Quayle. But he said he was head of the commission. And when the commission finished its work, they decided that when you put a foreign gene into a food, you don't have to regulate it. Foreign chemicals, yes, but foreign genes, you don't have to. And they considered that generally regarded as safe. Why? It was a mystery to me. Why? You take a gene from an Arctic carp, let's say, that has never met a lettuce plant, and you put the gene into the cell of the lettuce plant, and you grow up lettuce plants with the gene of an Arctic carp, and it's assumed to be generally regarded as safe. And I could never figure that out. But that was the policy that FDA had established in 1992, which came about from the Reagan administration. And that's been the policy since then. The Europeans had a very different policy. They said, no, if you put a foreign gene into food product that it didn't have before, you have to test it for safety. So then they began testing the food with animal tests. That's the way we test chemicals. So the good news about genetically engineered food is that we don't know of any cases where anybody has been killed. No cases. The bad news is we haven't done research to understand what the impacts of this new regime of food is likely to be. I have to remember a few things. It took this country 50 years to regulate lead. And believe me, the lead industry did exactly what the chemical industry has done. They even gave small children coloring books to show Mr. Lead and how safe it was, the lead paint and lead in the gasoline. They had children's coloring books. And it took about as that many years to find out that polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, was dangerous. And since the 1930s, they began to test DDT, and it was only banned in 1972, 10 years after Rachel Carson highlighted it in her book. So my estimate is that it takes between 25 and 50 years to ban or severely regulate a chemical in the United States. And that has to do with the system that we have. Drugs are a different story. When somebody submits a drug, it's assumed dangerous unless it's proven safe. So you have to prove the drug is safe. Sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes it's accepted, and then you find out it's dangerous after it's been approved. But at least the effort is there to prove it's safe. But chemicals, it's totally different. Many of the pesticides that are on the market today were approved 30, 40 years ago when the standards were very, very low. So they were grandfathered or grandmothered in. And to get rid of a pesticide takes a lot of regulatory action, which the regulatory agencies generally resist, because every time they take an action, the company that manufactures the product is going to sue the agency for not following some standard or other. So in the 1990s, Monsanto figured out a way to put some genetically modified material in corn and in soybeans so that when they sprayed an herbicide on it, it would not kill their soybean or their corn. So, you know, what's the purpose of the herbicide? It's to kill everything except your plant, because you don't want your plant to be competing with all the other things in the environment. You want your plant to get all the nutrients from the soil without competing with anything else. So Monsanto developed a seed called Ready Roundup Seed. Ready Roundup. Roundup is glyphosate. And the seed has to be used with the herbicide. So you buy them together. You plant the seed, you spray the herbicide. And as you can imagine, the sale of herbicides around the world of Roundup or glyphosate started to skyrocket and became the most purchased and used herbicide on the planet. And that's where we get into now the problems of how safe is it. When I first looked into glyphosate with a toxicology friend of mine, colleague of mine, 30 years ago, the data suggested it was pretty darn safe. The data suggested it. But I just did a little review just before I came here. And in the last 5 years, there were 800 new studies done on glyphosate. Wow, 800 new studies. Why didn't they do those studies when they first introduced it? What is it about the chemicals that they're introducing that they do most of the studies after the chemical has been on the market for 25 or 30 years. There are more studies done on DDT today than there was when it was first introduced in the 1940s and 50s. So I began thinking about this, and I was also thinking about why are there two worlds out there about GMOs? There's one world that says it's absolutely safe, you don't have to worry about it. And the other is another world that says, I won't go near the stuff, I'll only buy organic. They don't talk to each other much. They only cite the science that they feel supports their view. It makes it for very difficult to try to get some understanding of what the truth is. So I spent 2 or 3 years trying to delve into the science to find out what was true, what was untrue about genetically modified food. And hopefully that will be coming out in February with MIT Press, a book called GMOs Decoded. And I learned a great deal about delving into the science. First of all, I found out that the science was heavily politicized. That's an awful thing to have to admit, because scientists are trained with this, they're all trained with the same kinds of books and techniques. And why should one scientific group say that this is a probable carcinogen and another scientific group say that glyphosate is safe and is not a carcinogen? I was fascinated by that because, I mean, after all, the world has only one science. So why would two agencies come to completely different points of view? And in the process of investigating it, I began to learn about how this can happen. Well, one agency, IARC, which you mentioned, is under the World Health Organization. They have very strict rules of conflicts of interest. Also, they will not accept an article for review. They don't do studies themselves. They review existing studies. They will not accept an article in their review for cancer if the article has not been published in a peer-reviewed journal. Wow. So I compared EPA's evaluation of glyphosate with IARC's evaluation of glyphosate. Line by line, I found out that EPA had accepted 30 articles that were not published. They were from industry, and IARC did not. So you begin to see how two agencies can come up with different outcomes. And there were other things that bothered me. Very esteemed scientist who had done some work on GMOs, one in particular, in the UK, a senior scientist who had many, many grants, published a number of books, published a paper in Science magazine, which, as everyone knows, is you know, very difficult to get published in. And he was very eager to genetically engineer a potato with a protein that would prevent potato blight. He was from Scotland, and of course, we know the Irish had terrible potato blights in history. And when he found out that his genetically modified potatoes harmed his animals compared to the controls, he was fired within a few days because the Prime Minister in England didn't want to hear anything about it. I've just never heard of anything like this. And then a French scientist also came out with a result which was not favorable to GMOs. He got his results published in an American journal, a very prestigious journal. And then the backlash came from Monsanto, and they set up their special committees to show that this scientist was a charlatan. He was from the University of Caen in Normandy, well-trained toxicologist, and he worked with a group. His paper was peer-reviewed and was published in this journal. Within a year, the editor-in-chief of the journal retracted his paper without his permission. That sounded very suspicious to me. But even more strange was the reason he gave for the retraction. Now, there are standards for retracting a paper. If you committed scientific fraud, your paper is going to be retracted. If you violated a fundamental ethical principle about treating human subjects or even animals, your paper is going to be retracted. But this editor-in-chief said, "We're not retracting this paper because of any errors or because of any scientific misconduct. We're retracting this paper because the results were not definitive." I've never heard of anyone in the history of science retracting a paper because the results were not definitive. You might as well retract 99% of the papers that are published. And I see that there's some people in the audience who clearly understand that. Results are never definitive. Anyway, I began to realize how politicized this area of science was. And that makes it extremely difficult to understand whether GMOs are ultimately going to be safe or unsafe. And one of the things that can happen when you put a foreign gene into a plant is it interferes with other genes, which means it's quite possible if you get a genetically modified soybean that some of its nutrients will be depressed or microtoxins in the plant will be exacerbated. These are all possibilities and they all exist in the literature. And there's only one way to find out, and that's to test it. But we have no testing regimes in the United States. None. So it's very difficult when you're a layperson and you don't spend 20 years studying a field to know what the truth is. So you try to depend upon other sources. You go to friends who are experts. You read an article in the New York Times and you hope that they're correct and you hope you're getting some truth. And one of the things I did was I went to the systematic reviews. These are people who spent 20 years studying a field, and they're given the opportunity to review the literature of the field. And I found 8 systematic reviews looking at GMOs and doing studies of all the studies that were done on animals. 4 of them said they were totally safe. 4 of them said there were all kinds of problems and they caused damage to animals that were tested. So there you go. I have to remain skeptical and wait until we get a regime that allows us to fully test the GMOs as well as the Roundup, and not only the glyphosate itself, but the additives that they put into the Roundup. When they introduce a pesticide, they put in things into it to make it work more effectively. And I'll end up with this one story. In 2000, the city of Cambridge decided they were going to spray pesticides right down the streets of Mass Ave because of West Nile virus. The CDC said if you find a dead bird, draw a circle around it, a mile, and spray the entire area of the circle. Well, I want to know what they were spraying. The health department didn't actually know. Oh, synthetic pyrethroids. They used to come from flowers until they were synthetic. Then they were made in a laboratory. So I began investigating what they were spraying, having spent the day and the night during the spray in Concord, where they don't allow spraying. And I came back. And I found out that within the synthetic chemical that they test, there's another chemical that I found out is called piperonal butoxide. No one would ever know this. And it's not tested, but it's a carcinogen. So they were using piperonal butoxide in this pesticide. And why do they use the piperonal butoxide? Because it depresses the enzymes in our bodies and in the insects' bodies for destroying the pesticide. So in other words, it makes the pesticides more effective because it depresses our body's system of attacking the toxin. So there you go. You have to be aware of all of these things, of what we're facing. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure there are lots of people going to line up to ask lots of questions. But how do we trust the regulators when all the regulators are being peppered with ex-Monsanto employees now? How does the average man in the street get any kind of true sense of what's going on?
You know, the only thing you can do is to keep watch over what the agency does, to give them feedback every time they issue a new ruling. Let them hear from the public and watch their actions, watch their behavior. Make sure that they're not getting too friendly with industry. I have to tell you that in the Reagan administration, he appointed as the head of EPA Ann Gorsuch, the mother of our Supreme Court justice. She lasted for 2 years and had to leave ignominiously because she opened up the EPA to undue influence on the part of industry. Yeah. Her toxic substances chief was sent to jail. So these things happen. And you've got to have journalists, you've got to have academics, you've got to have people watching the agencies, watching their move, and they can be doing the right thing because there are good people there. They're well-trained people. You just have to keep watch.
Go ahead.
The point made in passing was disturbing to me. Namely, we're going to have to wait for a regime to change before we can actually do this testing. And the testing isn't really the issue because it's never tested to be safe. They just assert that there's no evidence it's unsafe. It's dangerous. So we're never going to get anywhere on that plane, it seems to me. It's going to be a numbers game. It seems to me perhaps a more powerful logic is to amplify what you've already done by looking at the things that are parallel to it. There's a whole structure of modern agriculture that's based on the principle of ecocide, right? Mm-hmm. Kill everything else except what we want at this moment, or what Monsanto and Bayer want at this moment. Further, there are other industries layered in on top of this, including fertilizer industry, right? And the agribusiness industries having to do with tractors and machinery. If you look at all that, it's not just pesticide-dependent agriculture, it's petro-dependent agriculture, whether it's the machinery, the herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, whatever, petrochemicals. Now, the logic of petro-intensive agriculture is suicidal because you're getting more and more people on a finite planet committed to consuming fewer and fewer varieties of crops that are grown with greater and greater subsidies from a substance you know you're running out of, petroleum. That can't be a recipe for food security. So it seems to me you need to, in effect, nest your case within a larger logic about the suicide of petro-intensive agriculture. And you'd win it overnight. Not because you've proved that a particular pesticide is carcinogenic, but you've proved that the system is suicidal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Certainly not sustainable.
I just wanted to ask you, I like the Environmental Health Network and Toxics Action because I don't think that just one person can make a big difference advocating for any kind of legislation. So I wondered if you had an organization that you liked, that you felt was effective.
There are a few groups that have alerted society. For example, there was a genetically modified corn that was only supposed to be used for animals, and it was found in taco shells.
Yeah.
And that was discovered by an environmental group that sent it out for study. So, you know, these public interest groups can actually cause agencies to push back and fine people who are responsible for putting out things that were not supposed to be put out. So, yeah.
Hi, I am a small organic farmer here in Massachusetts, and I was wondering if you guys had any way of activating the consumer to care more about where their food comes from, and how do you hope to change the food system without kind of getting more people to not just go for the cheap thing or not just go for the easy grocery store run, but to actually become involved in their food system.
I don't know how many of you remember Alar. This was a substance that was used on apple trees. It was sprayed on apple trees. The purpose of it was to get the apples to ripen at the same time so they can bring in a crew of people very efficiently and pick the apples. What they didn't tell people was that Alar, or diminazide, caused cancer in animals. So one day, an environmental group called the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, went ahead and had the apples test, the Alar tested, and the scientists came out with a study that said that there would be 5,000 children with cancer because of this substance, Alar. They, instead of publishing the paper, they went to 60 Minutes, and 60 Minutes did a story on Alar. And within a week, nobody was buying apples and apple juices. Nobody. The whole country was, you saw these signs that say no Alar in the supermarkets. So I was doing some work on risk assessment, and they called me down to Washington to speak to about 1,000 people, many of them farmers. So I got up there and I said, you know, you folks do a lot of research on the color of apples. You spend a lot of money on trying to make sure that the apples you produce are going to be favorable to people's aesthetic interests. Why don't you do a focus group? Bring a bunch of people around a table and say, we've got a product here that we use on apple trees, and oh, it causes cancer in mice, and your children drink an awful lot of apple juice. Should we put this on the market? Why didn't you do a focus group like that? And now, if you did, you wouldn't be in this situation where you've lost hundreds of millions of dollars because people don't want to buy apples and apple juice. Well, they were stunned that anybody would ask such a question. Yes, that's the things they should be doing. They should be testing the chemicals that they use in the apples and the agriculture, etc. And Alar was put off the market not by the regulators, but by the people, just by the knowledge. But how many times can you do that, you know?
I'd like to thank Professor Sheldon Krimsky for this wonderful presentation. You have been listening to the Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in October 2018 with Professor Sheldon Krimsky from Tufts University. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thanks very much for coming, and please come again.